Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 7th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Allocation of Resources, Personal Medicine versus Global Health. Our presenter is Jan Chalupny, session number CHJA 2006-9. Let's listen in.
High-tech things, there also should be a session on allocation of resources. Because high-tech stuff is really expensive, so there's an ethical issue there. What's the best way to spend healthcare dollars when you look at both this country and the whole world? So if you have, any of you may have much more expertise in this area than me, feel free to, by making a correct statement or if you have information in an area, feel free to share that. This is just kind of a discussion session to look at some of these issues and think about them. So I wanted to start with personalized medicine. Is anybody familiar with that term, what it means? It's something that comes up now in the news a little more often than it used to. Basically, it's mostly discussed in regards to treatment for cancer. Because cancer is a very unique disease to each individual who would contract it. So even two women with breast cancer, the cells affected may be different. The genetic causes may be quite different. So one treatment doesn't necessarily fit all. So that's what has spurred this sort of development. And this is still, it's not really available yet, but it's something that's being looked at by drug companies and also in academic settings as something to aim for. So this is an article from the Los Angeles Times from early in June this year, Customizing Cancer Care, which I'm just going to read a few blurbs from it. A new screening could predict the aggressiveness of a patient's disease and lead to more personalized and effective treatment. Right now, people get a one-size-fits-all treatment for cancer, and few other things get factored into the treatment, says Dr. Timothy Treach, a pathologist at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. As issue is the fact that even when two cancers from different patients appear identical, they may act differently and respond differently to the same drugs, presumably because the internal mistakes that have caused the cells to turn rogue or divide out of control, which is what is the cause of cancer, are not the same. And so scientists are seeking distinct genetic signatures, combinations of genes that are inappropriately active or inactive in cancer tissues. Scientists are excited about the prospects for customizing cancer therapies. We don't know how personalized it can get, says James Jacobson, a researcher at the National Cancer Institute, who helped evaluate the Institute's breast cancer trial. Ideally, we hope we can make an informed decision for every patient that walks in the door. So this is basically an approach that relies very much on things we can do with technology, and especially on something that's called array-based studies, DNA array studies, where you can, on a tiny chip of glass or silicone, you can have little pieces of DNA for all different types of genes on that tiny chip, and then you can take cancer patients, cancer cells from a patient, and isolate not the DNA, which is what the genes are made out of, but the RNA, because when genes are turned on, they get what's called transcribed into RNA. So if you look at the RNA, that represents only the genes that are on in those cells. Because all cells in their nuclei have the entire human genome, all the genes. But not every cell turns on every gene, depending on what type of cell it is, and then depending on if it's become what's called transformed, which means cancerous. So cells that are cancerous may upregulate certain genes. They may turn them on at a higher rate, or they may downregulate genes. They may kind of turn them off. So genes, for instance, that are involved in regulating cell growth may be turned off. And so personalized medicine refers to looking at an individual cancer patient's cells, looking at the DNA, looking at the RNA to see what's turned on, and then comparing it with normal tissue. So seeing if some genes are way turned on, way high, and some are kind of turned off compared to normal. So you're comparing it to normal. And then you're looking for signatures. So it's something that will also rely on compiling a lot of data, looking at which types of cancer respond well to which types of treatments. So, you know, several years from now, doctors may know, well, cancer patients in which the cells have upregulated these four genes and downregulated these four respond well to this treatment. Whereas patients that have upregulated this other four and downregulated this other two respond well to this treatment. So it's a very personalized type of care, but it also relies a lot on technology and can be very expensive.
How close are they to that?
I don't know of any place that's actually doing it yet, although somebody might be, but it's not commonly available at all. But it's something that a lot of research groups are still trying to compile data. It's something that they'll probably start trying to. They're at the stage now where they can look at individual cancer patients, the RNA from the cells from their cancers, and see what's upregulated and downregulated. That's definitely doable. It's just having the database of what types of genetic upregulations and downregulations respond well to which types of treatment. That's not known.
But it seems to me you can go down a lot of blind alleys, too.
Yeah, that's potentially true. And it also costs a lot of money to do these types of screening on people as you try and compile enough data to then be able to actually help people by saying, well, we won't waste time putting you on this drug because we can tell by the signature of your cancer cells that you're not going to respond to that drug. We'll try you on this drug. Or we know that cells that have this genetic profile respond better to this other drug that's just come on the market or whatever. So that's what personalized medicine is. And it sounds pretty cool, you'd be treated for exactly what your problem is, and a lot of time could be saved by not prescribing something that's not going to work. But at the same time, there's kind of the prevention versus treatment conundrum. Especially for cancer and diabetes, there's a lot of information suggesting, and even, really strong support for the idea that lifestyle changes could prevent a lot of cancers as well as a lot of diabetes. Some people have genetic predispositions to both of these types of disease, but a genetic predisposition doesn't mean for sure you're going to get that disease. And perhaps if you're doing things in your lifestyle, that are harmful, that's going to hurry you along on that path towards disease. And for diabetes, also, there's very strong evidence that lifestyle changes could affect cures for many, many people rather than treating with drugs after the fact. This is an article from the Wall Street Journal from April of this year stating that as many as half of cancer deaths could be prevented if more people made lifestyle changes such as avoiding smoking and excessive sun exposure, eating nutritiously, and getting regular exercise and recommended health screenings, according to a study from the American Cancer Society. Whether due to socioeconomic or personal challenges, many people have trouble following common health precautions. So some of that may be due to economic differences. Regular health screenings means that either your insurance provider needs to cover those or you have to pay for them out of pocket. So that may make a difference in how many individuals pursue those avenues. But other lifestyle changes such as avoiding smoking or eating nutritiously or getting regular exercise would be more doable for most people. Although I think there is evidence from some studies to suggest that people of lower socioeconomic groups tend to do those kind of things less. maybe they're working two jobs to pay the bills, and so joining a gym or even strapping on some running shoes and going for a jog every day isn't really in their day plan. You know, they're just concerned with trying to pay the bills. And diabetes, cancer, on the one hand, is not really on the rise. I mean, I think it gets diagnosed more often correctly than it used to, and people live longer, so they live long enough to develop cancer, but it's not increasing. However, diabetes is kind of approaching an epidemic in this country and in other countries as well. This is an excerpt from a New York Times article from June of this year, stating that the number of people around the world suffering from diabetes has skyrocketed in the last two decades from 30 million to 230 million, claiming millions of lives and severely taxing the ability of healthcare systems to deal with the epidemic, according to data released Saturday by the International Diabetes Federation. While the growing problem of diabetes in the affluent United States has been well documented, the Federation's data show that 7 of the 10 countries with the highest number of diabetics are in the developing world. China now has the largest number of diabetics over age 20, around 39 million people, or 2.7% of the adult population. And it goes on to say that in some of the world's poorest nations, the disease is a quick death sentence. While Americans can live for many years with the disease, a person in Mozambique who requires injections of insulin can expect to live just a year. I'm assuming that's because they're unable to get those regular injections of insulin. In Mali, such people survive about 30 months. There are many factors driving the growth of diabetes worldwide, but most experts agree that changes in lifestyle and diet are the chief culprits, in addition to genetic predisposition. As developing countries rapidly industrialize, people tend to do work involving less physical activity. At the same time, the availability of food that is cheap but high in calories becomes more common. And then they also state that the diabetes epidemic will overwhelm healthcare resources everywhere if governments do not wake up now and take action. And there are also a lot of articles in the health or science sections of papers, like this one, which is entitled Health Spending Likely to Outpace Economy's Growth. So we have a lot of high-tech drugs that are developed using biotechnology that are quite expensive, and it's unclear whether Medicare and Medicaid can keep pace, whether insurance companies can keep pace as the prices of these drugs rise. Can we keep pace with that money-wise in our national economies and in our own personal lives? Since I've been here, I've been reading this book, The Truth About Drug Companies. So this strikes really close to home for me since I work for one, which is actually mentioned in this book in one small part of a chapter. And it's been really illuminating. The subtitle is How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It. And it's written by Dr. Marcia Angell, who was the editor of New England Journal of Medicine for many years. So she's watched how drug companies' practices have changed over the years, and her opinion is not that drug companies are completely bad. Her opinion is that there are innovative drugs out there that are going to be helpful to people, and we need to have drug companies, but that drug companies need to be reformed because they spend an incredible amount on sales and marketing, much more, in her opinion, than on research and development. Although what the industry says usually is that we spend so much on R&D that we have to charge a lot for these drugs to make up what we spend. And they do spend quite a bit in R&D, but what Dr. Angell says is that they spend way more on marketing sales and marketing. But it's hard to figure that out from their company, the company reports, because they don't really itemize that. They call it marketing and administration.
Yeah, so I have a bit of disclosure here. So I work for a biotech company in San Diego. We do enzymes, and we do, in fact, some common biotechnology. And I took a drug discovery class as part of my career development because I figured I might not be just working in enzymes, but I might be working for a pharma company someday. And they were training us as scientists, not as, I mean, I come from a PhD background, just so I'm not, so that I'm a pure scientist. And they were explaining that it takes $1 billion to develop a drug these days, and a lot of it, 90% of the spending is on clinical trials. So the business model for drug companies today is just completely skewed. I mean, they can't go for something simple that'll cure what they call orphan diseases or small segments of the population. I mean, if you start doing personalized medicine, that blows their business model completely out of the water because there's no way they can fund anything that will pay back a $4 or $5 billion over the cost of the time. I mean, it takes $1 billion in about 10 to 20 years to come from conception of a particular molecule, a particular idea that you have, all the way through all the clinical trials. And then, as you might be aware, there's phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials. And then what there's what we call euphemistically phase 4, which is once it's on the market, will something happen to it, like what happened to BIOX? You know, you can try to check for toxicity, you can try to check for efficacy, but it's a different beast, like compared to like a hothouse. You know, a flower might do very well in a controlled situation, but once you let it loose in the wild, or once you let that drug out in the wild, there's always going to be a lot of unintended consequences. So even when the drug company does mean well, and there isn't corruption, or there isn't a desire to hide things, I mean, it's incredibly expensive, just the R&D alone, and then let alone when you start adding in the sales and the marketing. I mean, I don't mean to be any sort of apologist for them, but I think that this is a fact that most people have no awareness of how long it takes to kind of put that out.
Right, well, I come from the same background, PhD background, pure science, working for a company. And it's true that the R&D costs a lot, but the stand from this book is that companies overblow, in her opinion, what they spend on R&D and don't really discuss how much they spend on sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. Another one of her critiques is that there are not that many innovative drugs out there, not as many as there maybe should be. There are a lot of Me Too drugs, partially spurred by, oh, this company's got a blockbuster, like Viagra or whatever, Zoloft. Let's make one just like it. If we, you know, as you can't just like it, it has to be a teeny bit different so you can get a patent, but let's make one of those. Or the company's own product is going off patent. Let's make a slight change, very, very slight change, and call it something new. Say that it's better, which it may or may not be, and now we have a patent on this new drug, which isn't really new.
So the other thing they do before they go off patent, too, is they will raise the price. What is it? Is it 13 years? I think before they go off patent.
Well, the patent's now 20 years from the time you file, but you still do clinical trials during that time and get FDA approval. So by the time you're done with that, you no longer have 20 years.
Then what they do about the last 3 years, though, is they tend to then skyrocket the price to recoup as much as they can from their initial investment.
Mm-hmm. So this is a pretty interesting book, especially for me, since I work in this industry. You know, and she does, you know, she's not completely knocking the industry, and she does say, you know, there are good people in the industry, people that really want to come up with innovative drugs that help people, but the industry could use some reform. So I recommend this if any of you are interested in that kind of stuff. And she does give suggestions at the back. I skipped ahead to the back because I'm not done yet, but she does give suggestions in the back, both things that she should be done, that she thinks would improve the industry and make it more cost-effective and more accountable. Especially clinical trials, that's one of her major critiques, is that clinical trials are run, by and large, by the drug companies themselves. So there's a conflict of interest there. They've invested a ton of money in this drug, and so they want to, even if they're not doing it intentionally, which they may be, they want to make it look as good as they can after they spend all this money. So there's the It's tempting to not show some of the bad data, to only show the good data, things like that. And so one of her suggestions is there should be a government body that, or some sort of body that has no ties with the drug industry, that oversees these clinical trials and makes sure they're done properly and that data is reported in an unbiased fashion, so that the FDA can then make a true assessment of whether this is a new, if this drug is better than, if it's a Me Too drug, is it truly better than the one that preceded it? Is it safe? Is it novel? Is it better? And she also includes things to do personally, you know, like if your doctor prescribes a new drug, ask him or her certain questions. You know, what is the evidence that this drug is better than an alternative drug or some other approach for treatment? Has the evidence been published in a peer-reviewed medical journal, or are you relying on information from the drug company representatives? And try to get a reference to a journal article or a medical text before you can actually read information about the study. Is this drug better only because it is given at a higher dose? Sometimes when Me Too drugs are tested, they're tested at a higher dose than the former drug, so they look better. But if you use the old drug at the same dose, it might perform the same, but you don't know because no one ever did that. Are the benefits worth the side effects, the expense, and the risk of interactions with other drugs I take? Is this a free sample? Free samples are a thing that drug companies do a lot. They give doctors free samples, which are passed on to patients. But as you can see, you know, if it really works for you, you're not going to try anything else. So it's a little bit of a getting you hooked on the free stuff, and then when you have to actually pay for it out of pocket, it's quite expensive. If so, is there a generic drug or an equivalent drug I can use that is cheaper when the free samples run out? Do you have any financial ties with the company that makes this drug? For example, do you consult with the company? Other than free drug samples, do you receive gifts from drug companies? Are you being paid to put me on this drug and enroll me in a drug company study? Do you make time for visits from company drug representatives? So I've never asked any of those questions to my doctor.
Just this last year in a session, the American Medical Association, just by a very, very, very narrow margin, did not pass a resolution that no physician in Oregon could accept samples from drug reps, that no doctor in Oregon can accept a sample from a drug rep. And it almost passed. And the only thing that kept it from passing were the free clinics who are saying that without these free samples, we can't provide. Mm-hmm. And that was really the only reason it was defeated. But there was really quite underground movement that became a major movement that, you know, we won't accept free samples from drug reps for that kind of reason. You know, of course, there are those that argue too, well, you know, maybe I'm above that, maybe I can make those kinds of informed choices, maybe they're not influencing me. But enough people believe that maybe that was happening, that we were going to pass that kind of resolution. But it didn't. Mostly because of free clinics.
When I was a poor undergraduate student, the doctor knew that I couldn't afford some sort of medicine. Mm-hmm. I don't remember, it was for something pretty innocuous. But then he was kind of continually giving me free samples, and then, you know, for the course of what I had. I mean, obviously it wasn't something perpetual, but I mean, you know, sometimes some doctors use that as a way to treat people who wouldn't have access to treat them at all. So, I don't know, it's mixed bag.
Yeah, her take on that would be if drug companies were forced to reform in certain aspects, then the price of drugs would come down because you know, they wouldn't be giving all those free gifts. Drug companies do a lot of education of doctors, which she argues is biased from the start because it's the drug companies doing it.
Well, again, so the state of Oregon, that's just not allowed anymore. I mean, it used to be a few years ago, but now you can't even take a spouse to a meeting. There's no free dinners, there's no plays, there's no entertainment, there's nothing. Matter of fact, you can't give any kind of gift that isn't medically related. So the best you'll ever see is a pin and a scratch pad. That's what they're limited to in Oregon right now. Which
right, well,
I don't have any objection
to it either, but, you know, yeah, they should be limited in that way everywhere. Because it's also true that the same drug can cost much less in Canada than here.
But it's interesting, having done that, the price hasn't gone down.
Right. No, the argument is that they spend all the R&D money in the U.S., so the U.S. should recoup those costs, and so they charge much more in the U.S. than, you know, the very same thing in the very same box in Canada costs a lot less. So anyway, that's just an issue to think about, and that I've been thinking about a lot more than I have in the past since I've been reading this, and just that there, you know, it's not like the industry's bad, but perhaps improvements could be made, because also if drug prices remain that high, or keep rising at greater than the rate of salaries and things like that, eventually we're going to reach a place where these things just aren't going to be covered by insurance companies, and then that makes the disparity between economic strata even greater. You know, if you can't afford them out of pocket, you're just not going to get them.
Another aspect of the drug companies, I heard the NPR piece, and drug companies will build up a disease or a problem and make it, you know, in their advertising or commercials and things, to draw people in to ask their doctor for those particular drugs, because they see the commercial that says, you know, if you have this condition, this is what you need.
Well,
and
she brings that up in this book as well, because in fact, the U.S. is the only nation other than New Zealand that allows direct-to-consumer marketing on television and billboards and things like that. It's against the law in all other countries. And the argument is we should tell people what's out there so that they can ask for it. But she says if the person telling them is the person selling it, that's a conflict of interest. And she does have some examples where, for instance, Prozac, it went off patent. And so it's been repackaged in a pink or purple pill called Seraphim for premenstrual distress syndrome. And her argument then is that should people be medicated in that way? Are you making people think that they have something when maybe they don't? I mean, some women seriously have premenstrual syndrome that needs to be medicated in some way for them to be able to cope. But having it on the television all the time then can create in someone's mind, yeah, I feel bad at that, you know, before I start my period. You know, maybe I need this Prozac to feel better, but maybe you don't need something like that to feel better. And so, yeah, that's one of her critiques of drug companies, that they try to, you know, sort of create a market for their product.
When was that? That wasn't always a lot of it, was it? Was there?
No.
When was it
no,
started?
I'm not sure exactly when it was allowed, but she said before 1997 there were hardly ever ads on television because the requirement was that you had to state all the side effects. And in a 30-second spot, you don't have time. And then in 1997 there was legislation passed that relaxed that control so that they don't have to list it. They have to give a way to find that information, so like call this toll-free number if you have other questions. But they don't have to list absolutely every side effect, so it makes it easier to have.
Isn't it such that, I mean, there are two kinds of ads. There's one where they tell you what it does, and then they have to list the side effects. There's some where they never tell you what it does.
Yeah, ask your doctor about the purple pill. Oh,
right.
Do I mean that? So like, purple pill for what?
Do I need the purple pill?
Why
would
I ask them about it? I don't even know. As a scientist, that kind of stuff drives me crazy. One where there's dots floating across the screen. Look, these dots are going over here, and that's better because they're equally distributed. Like, what are the dots? Educating me about this drug that might be helpful for something that I have when you don't say what it's for, and you don't tell me what the dots are. So that's one of her arguments, too, that these aren't really educational ads. They're trying to sell something, and you should completely disregard them because they're biased, and the doctors should be the ones, you know, reading the studies and understanding what goes on and then passing that information on to their patients who have the syndrome or disease that this would be used to treat, and not that it should be all up in the newspapers and TV.
I think there's the other issue too, that there are so many drugs hitting the market, physicians cannot possibly keep up with
it. Yeah,
and so in a sense the drug companies crutch that, and and provide information, and you know, and so these are the things to kind of help that, if you will, education process to give them more acumen. But the net of it is, it's almost like the same thing we have with the Islamic issue. Where do you get good information? That's really the issue. And we're getting more and more consumer oriented, and less and less. The healthcare company I work for is getting more interested in a sense, integrated delivery systems are wholesaling medical care, and the retailers are really insurance companies. So now they're kind of looking at that model again because it's not working well. And there are insurance companies able to get better rates on some things by establishing gatekeepers that keep some actually high cost procedures out of the mix, if you will. And the whole point is we're trying to help people, you know. And so there, it's a really complex scenario. So it kind of depends on where you want to start putting your effort. I mean, but education is clearly...
You, in terms of the allocation of resources, we already have this big uproar between PPOs and HMOs. I mean, here the HMO's trying to do the best bang for the buck, but then if somebody's got something rare and expensive, you are SOL, you know? So, I mean, then they were trying to figure out the most humane or efficient way to spend the money, and then you can also look at the socialized medicine in Britain for that. I mean, there they are trying to spend the money efficiently, but then if you have some sort of specialized procedure, you need the best in the world, where are you going to come? You're going to come to this country. You know, otherwise you're going to wait with us until you're basically dead. So, you know, if we can't even work that out, I don't know how, you know, we can get to the point of saying the rich versus the poor. The other thing I was wondering, I don't know if you have a comment about drug companies. Like, one rumor that sort of I hear pretty often is that drug companies kind of have a financial incentive to go after rich country diseases. You know, they're not interested in making vaccines. I mean, part of the reason I heard we didn't have...
Oh yeah, she mentions that in here too. Yeah. And all the four companies make vaccines.
Right,
so
right.
We face shortages of vaccines.
Right, there's no Tamiflu, right, for example, because there's no money, even though that might benefit a lot of individual people. So you might have the rich country diseases, and then you also have the issue of either lifestyle or, you know, like Viagra, things like that. But then drug companies are also kind of motivated to not do lifestyle diseases that are not lethal, because it's one thing if a cancer patient is told, take this drug or you will die, you know, they'll have a very different utility value than someone saying, well, I can't sleep very well. You know, so, you know, it's kind of easier in some ways to pass the clinical trials if the outcome is very obvious, like live or die, versus how do you interpret the results, versus, well, I slept better last night, versus...
Yeah,
you know,
there was a paragraph in here where she addresses that, or partially. This conclusion was underscored, where she says, the result is too many people end up taking drugs when there are better ways to deal with their problems. This conclusion was underscored by a large trial sponsored by the National Institutes of Health of ways to prevent adult onset diabetes in people at high risk for the disease. One group in the trial received a placebo, and 29% of the patients in that group developed diabetes over a three-year period. The second group received a drug called metformin, a generic form of Bristol-Myers Squibb's blockbuster glucophage, and they did somewhat better, 22% developed diabetes. But the third group did much better than either of the other two. They were placed on a moderate diet and exercise program, and only 14% got diabetes. In other words, diet and exercise were better than the drug. But trying diet and exercise instead of a drug is not likely to happen in real life. Drenched as we all are in prescription drug promotions, both doctors and patients are far more likely to go for the glucophage. Besides, insurers don't usually pay for diet and exercise programs.
But that's interesting too, because in my drug development class, they were saying that, you know, for the diabetes things, like, would people, for example, one of our projects was to try to develop a drug. And they said, should we make it? So one of the questions was, do we make it oral or do we make it injection only? And so, you know, then the question was, how many people are willing to inject themselves if they know it's not going to, you know what I mean? Like, a diabetic is willing to go through the nuisance of injecting and testing every day because they know the alternative is they're going to die. But then if it's something like controlling your weight or your blood pressure, you know, something more abstract or something more lifestyle, then they said, well, you know, people only tolerate an oral drug that they take once a day. So then the question is kind of chicken and egg, like, what are the patient's expectations and the drug companies are playing guessing games about what people are willing to do. And then the patients feel manipulated because they're getting all this advertised. So it's kind of like, where did all this madness start? So I don't know. I mean.
Well, let's move away from the drug industry a little bit for a minute and just think a little about global health challenges. So challenges in areas of the developing world where personalized medicine is not even on their radar screen. You know, they can't even get a vaccine, probably. So there are a lot of global health challenges that I've listed there that really cause serious illness and death in those countries. Poor nutrition. This is a recent article from the Seattle PI by UNICEF and their statement about malnutrition. Poor nutrition contributes to the deaths of some 5.6 million children every year, and the world has fallen far short in efforts to reduce hunger by half before 2015, the UN Children's Fund said Tuesday. So clearly, just hunger issues are a huge concern in much of the world. You know, not to us necessarily, but millions of lives could be saved if people had enough to eat. Which brings me to another book. I'm not being paid by the bookstore, but every time I go into the bookstore thinking, like, oh, I'm going to get a novel, and you know, I've got some time to be reading it, hold it. I end up with something like this, you know, question my profession, and then I end up with something like this, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, where I have to question my lifestyle. Not that that's a bad thing, it's just, you know, difficult. And I've just barely started this book, but it's written by a guy who really argues that all the more affluent nations in the world really need to do something about this problem. And if we spent more than we do right now, you know, we're not... Here's my little... He has all sorts of interesting graphs and things. How generous are we? This is estimated official development assistance from industrialized countries as percentage of gross national product. This is 1993. So Denmark gives 1%, 1.03, and they're at the top end of the list. They give the most.
I'm sorry, gives to what? He gives to what?
Official development assistance to developing countries, you know, food and technology and medical care and whatnot. So Denmark's first with 1.03%. Then comes Norway, Sweden, Netherlands, France, Finland, Canada, Belgium, Germany, Australia, Switzerland, UK, Italy, Austria, Japan, New Zealand, Ireland, and finally the US with 0.15% of our GNP being used to help developing nations with problems like hunger and fighting other diseases. So, you know, we're definitely one of the most affluent countries of the world, but we're not at the top of the list or even in the top 10 as far as how much we give to help our brothers and sisters in other countries with problems like poor nutrition. So, like I said, I've just gotten started with this, and I think it's going to be a really challenging and interesting book.
Just a comment. I'm sorry, I was out hiking.
That's okay.
But on global health challenges, I think it was in one of the news magazines, like 60 Minutes or like that kind of stuff. They talked about it, and I think it's a real important issue, that too often countries will try to solve solutions without using the existing infrastructure or try to set up an infrastructure that's foreign to the people that live in that country. And the example they gave was, in fact, it was actually a series on AIDS. And it was in Nigeria, where they've had a real high AIDS rate. It's really come down. They've had a really effective AIDS program there. But first, our country, the U.S., had sent over tons and tons of stuff for, I don't know what the drugs are, but for that kind of stuff. They just sat there. Had no distribution service in order to get into the people, most of which were rural. And so eventually what happened then, and I don't know if it was the U.S. or another, it doesn't really matter, another group came in and trained local people to deliver those drugs on bicycles out into the rural areas, and using local people. And it just really caught on, because AIDS was a real big, you know, taboo in Nigeria. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to get tested or so forth. But then when somebody finally would convince their local people to do that, then they would see their local people carrying the medicine or whatever on the bicycles to the village and inquire about it, and the knowledge about AIDS and AIDS testing became, in fact, actually it's one of the best, the world's the best AIDS programs in the globe. I think they said they cut it like 90% or something like that, which is unbelievable.
Well, in a common sense way, it just kind of makes sense, right?
It does.
People learn something from their neighbor who they know and trust. They're going to take that more seriously than
but
the foreign person arrives and goes, do this because I said so, but you don't know who I am.
But too often, that's what I know in the United States. I see, I've lived overseas and I've seen it in other things too, but I think probably a lot of the industrial nations are guilty of this. But another example, which is, well, it is kind of health related actually. I lived in Egypt for a little bit over a year in Cairo, and the World Bank, a big organization with loans and stuff, or supplies to developing countries, sent over, oh gosh, I don't know what it was a huge number of garbage trucks to Cairo, because it's a big problem in Cairo, the garbage. And so, but after about 2 years of having them, they were all broken and run down, and there was no maintenance program. They couldn't fix them. They were just sitting on the street, empty hulks and shells. I mean, because again, a country tried to go in and with their views of how it should be, or their mindset of how the world works, into a country where that's just simply not true. But excuse me, and they're developing that, which, you know, it's like giving, I mean, that's a bad analogy, but it's like giving a kid a chemistry set and telling them to do a scientific experiment or something. I mean,
with no instructions.
Yeah, with no instructions. And the same thing also with Cairo, and this is where I have a lot of familiarity with, but there's a big old cement processing plant south of Cairo, about 20 miles, I guess it is, in Helwan's, the name of the city. And huge smokestacks that just pour pollution into the air, okay? And the European and the United States was involved in putting pollution control devices on those stacks to help with the air pollution and stuff. Within a year, they weren't functioning, and nobody knew how to clean them, nobody knew how to take out the filters. So I guess I'm just saying that part of our health challenge is also is not just money for drugs and that kind of stuff, because if it's just dumped off or whatever, or it's just trying to use the way that we think, it ain't going to work. I mean, I've seen it too many times.
Now, one of the things that, at least in the short amount of this book that I read, that Ronald Sider recommends is the small development assistance companies that give the micro loans to people,
yes.
And that those really work. You can loan somebody a very small amount of money, and they can build a small business with that that makes a huge difference in their quality of life. And it doesn't mean necessarily that they build a brand new house and move into it or get a car, but just that they have enough money to buy food and seek some medical treatment. Basic medical treatment if they need it, or install a pump to get clean water, just basic things. But that, you know, if an individual gave one of those micro loan companies, and there are a couple he recommends in here.
We belong to actually to one, my wife and I do. Opportunity International.
I think that's
which
one
is an excellent organization. They give micro loans to people in countries. Some of the countries they were not able to do, so they just left because they would. Work. But in the countries that they're in, and they're all throughout the world, they have something like 95% payback on their loans.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And we actually went on a trip. We went on a trip to Guatemala associated with that. There are trips that you can take. We saw and talked to the people that actually got loans to get a tortilla machine in Guatemala so they could service all the people in the town and work. They would come flocking to the place. It's just a simple wheel, okay, but it speeded up the process, or she's able to, actually, as a woman, she was able to open up the business, not only do that, but produce a lot of stuff over a short period of time during the lunch breaks and so forth, and it was just amazing to see those people and how excited they were about, we went to a shoe factory, went to a rug factory, like you said, hardly any of them are building houses, really, I mean, at least with the ones that we went, they're all for just small businesses, which produce seed kinds of things, and then it provides employment, provides everything income, and then it just kind of keeps spreading. And they're under very strict, at least with Opportunity International, they're under very strict guidance in terms of they have people that go into, and actually knows a couple of these people that go into areas, work with them, teach them how to do a business and keep track of books and all that other kind of stuff. So it's like a highly recommended.
Water and sanitation, also a huge challenge in the developing world. Just some statistics from the Red Cross. In our world today, more than 1 billion people do not have access to clean water. Over 2 billion people do not have adequate sanitation facilities. Some 4 million people die each year from diseases associated with the lack of access to safe drinking water, inadequate sanitation, and poor hygiene. 4,000 children under 5 years old die every day from those same associated diseases, which are things like diarrhea, cholera, dysentery, typhoid, guinea worm, hepatitis, and diseases that are carried by mosquitoes that breed in the standing or unclean water, like malaria and West Nile virus. So these are all things, you know, how many of us worry about dysentery or cholera? You know, we turn the water on in the tap and it comes out and it's clean, and we flush the toilet and the waste goes away to the water treatment, sewage treatment facility. So those are just, you know, things that cost a lot less than personalized medicine, but would have a huge effect as far as saving lives in the world. HIV/AIDS, we've touched on in some countries, it's really devastating, and there are just tons and tons of kids orphaned because their parents have both died from AIDS, and it's really an enormous tragedy that, again, we don't think about here that much, because here, most of the time, people have access to much better medical care and can get drugs that prolong their lives and improve their lives and their symptoms. And childbirth, that's another life-threatening condition in many parts of the world. Many women don't survive childbirth. And that's, again, something that we don't think about that much here. You know, you go to the hospital and it's clean and sanitation is good, or you choose to have your child at home with a midwife, but you have access to medical care if you need it. Although, again, all of these things can be an issue in this country depending on the socioeconomic status of the individual. Poorer people traditionally have poor nutrition. Well, not traditionally, but now, with a lot of processed foods and such, poorer people may have poorer nutrition than more affluent people, and would be less likely to have their water supply always be clean, sanitation, etc. Childbirth, less prenatal care if you don't have the money to pay for it, or if you don't have insurance to pay for it. And just the other day, I was entering the chalet that I was staying in, and I noticed this newspaper sitting on the table with the headline, "Economic Equality is the Best Medicine." So I thought, I gotta read that. This is the session that I'm least qualified to teach, but I think it's important to talk about it. I'm gonna talk about high-tech DNA technology and things like that in my other sessions. So I took a look at it and made a copy of it. And it's very striking, and it's something that apparently many people have known for a long time, but I did not know this. That countries with economic equality tend to have better health care and better health overall in their citizens. It starts out saying, the headlines read that rich Americans aren't as healthy as poor Brits, despite our spending twice as much money on health care as they do. Our newborns die at the highest rate of any rich country, even with our ever-advancing medical technologies. The feds report our mortality rates have never been lower. The United Kingdom study director suggests it is the nature of an unequal society in the United States that affects everybody, while experts over here are puzzled what is going on. So this is written by a person who's, I'm not sure how to pronounce their last name, Stephen Vezruchka, MD, MPH. So he's a medical doctor and has a master's in public health. And he's with the University of Washington.
So he goes on to say, who can tell us the answer to what makes a population healthy? Few in this country know because we don't ask that question. Anyone who does is marginalized for acting stupid. I was told, medical care, of course, that's why we are teaching you to be a good doctor. Our federal government, in its Institute of Medicine 2003 report, which is called The Future of the Public's Health in the 21st Century, states on page 59, more egalitarian societies, i.e. those with a less steep differential between the richest and the poorest, have better average health. This remarkable finding has emerged from research carried out over the last 25 years, and the science is as good as that linking smoking and poor health, which, you know, that link is pretty average. But smoking predisposes you to a number of health problems, various cancers, emphysema, et cetera, heart disease. The United States used to be one of the healthiest countries in the world when egalitarian principles were near the horizon. President Kennedy told us not to ask what our country can do for us, but to ask what we can do for our country. His request came after a decade of policies in which the poor made relatively more economic gains than the rich, something Robin Hood might have admired. And then he goes on to say, during the last 30 years, the rich have gotten much richer, and they're strayed far from egalitarian ideals. The increasingly steep differential between the richest and poorest is the reason why we are as healthy as Cuba, the country we have been strangling for almost 47 years. While our health as a nation has been improving, other countries are seeing better and faster results. People in more than 25 countries, including nearly all the rich nations and a few poor ones as well, live longer and healthier lives than we do. Then he goes on to talk about Washington State, which is setting up something called the Washington State Health Foundation, and their goal is to make the state of Washington the healthiest in the country. According to a composite indicator used to rank the health of states, we have fallen to 15th place, while Minnesota is first and Louisiana is last. To effect real change and improve health through this country, I suggest we strive to make Louisiana first in the nation. That state has among the highest infant death rates, the shortest length of life, the highest homicide rates, the highest teen birth rates, and the biggest gap between rich and poor. Katrina's aftermath was no accident. By concentrating on improving health in this country's worst off state, everyone will do better. We talk a lot in various sessions about, you know, one person suffering in the body of Christ, world, all of us suffer. And I think this is, it's interesting to read something like this where studies really bear out that if there's less economic disparity in the country, the overall health is better. And that just brings me to another thing I wanted to touch on, what is health? You know, in this country, we think a lot about health as far as medical care, a treatment for a disease or a cure for that disease, better yet. Treatment for physical symptoms. But what about emotional and spiritual health? You know, that kind of health can affect physical health as well. And I think it's pretty clear that probably all of us have experienced what, if we're under intense stress, we're more likely to become ill, to come down with something because you're tired. And
I also think that a cure or treatment for disease is not always healthy. You know, we all know stories of people whose lives have been prolonged and prolonged and prolonged through bitter, desperate struggles against a disease that cost everyone, that the dying person and their loved ones, so much in terms of the agony that they go through. In recent years, because of my increasing age, I've been asked to accompany several friends who are dying, and I'm in that process now with a third friend. And to see people make decisions about the path of their death, that, you know, my father was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, and he was told he'll have as much as 3 years to live, and he lived about 3 years, and he said, what a gift! I get to thank everybody I've wanted to thank. I get to apologize to everybody I've wanted to apologize to. You know, I get to clean up my mess and tell everybody I love them. But these two people who I accompanied were both had between 3 and 6 months, and they both really used it beautifully and gracefully and created community around them instead of fragmenting it, and did not fight bitterly, with every weapon in a medical arsenal, but instead gathered in their spiritual support. So, we have this idea here that death is a terrible thing. But even in my work and death penalty work, if you can come to some personal reconciliation with yourself and with your environment, you can take the path that might lead to death much more peacefully. Death in our faith is not so bad.
So, but, in response to that, I'm a family physician, so, I would imagine at least twice, maybe 3 times a month, right in front of that. But the fight is the technology is there. And just the week before I came here, there was this beautiful 87-year-old woman. She's 87. God, I love her. But she needed a new heart valve. And so she came along and I was thinking I'm doing this. And you go, you don't do that in front of her, but you're what? The cardiologist told me I needed to do this, and my son told me I needed to do this, and my buddy and I. So my voice, they're saying, you don't need to do this, All of the healthcare knowledge is going to go for your last month of life, and it's going to be really lousy. You're going to want to go there. And I fight, I tell the family, don't. Well, so she didn't. She died. After two weeks. And I'm not saying that I had the right vision that was going to happen. You just look at the statistics. And maybe she would die without it. Well, maybe she'll die with it, which she did. Then that scenario repeats itself. Whether it's aggressive cancer treatment, it's something that's going to take them anyway. It's just an uphill battle. And one that I struggle with.
We're really addicted to.
We're addicted to
treatment.
To treatment.
My dad went around his 5 children and asked permission to not have be intubated or extreme.
Well, nobody wants military shallow.
Right.
That whole scenario brings up another question, which is kind of like a little bit off. That is, it's so important to have a living will, and so important to have medical directions.
And so, before you're in that position, you cannot say what you want because
my wife and I are both 50, and we've done it since we were about 35. But then we go review them every so often, and then change it and so forth. And a lawyer can help you do that. But it depends on your state. Texas is very simple, actually.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to get us off into this other direction.
I think you make a really good point. And I think we really need to think about what the role of community is and how much that can play a role in our health. Family, friends, other community, church group, whoever it is, that can affect your health.
I had a question about that economic justice statement, actually, and I don't know if this is more politically minded everything, but I don't know if we're all aware that Warren Buffett gave the majority of his wealth to the Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. And so the Gates Foundation is sort of innovative in its tackling some of these huge challenges.
And they
fund this microcredit lending and everything, and so they had a different approach to philanthropy because they only fund the works. So they're treating it as if it's a business now. They say, we're not just going to pour money into a black hole out of, road to hell being paved with good intentions and all that. So they have to be ruthless enough to say, okay, you look like you have a good enough idea. Give us a business plan for how you're going to do it. We'll review you in 6 months, a year, 3 years, and then if it looks like it's not working, we'll cut you off, and then we're going to put the money elsewhere. So that's really what businesses do in order to be successful, right? And you kind of wonder, whether or not that kind of, business ruthlessness that our culture created and led to some of that economic injustice could be now, plowed back into the system in some ways. Because, here you have Bill Gates, and you can't even begin to imagine how wealthy he is compared to, regular American. I mean, I read somewhere that, you know, if your regular American won't even stoop over to pick up a penny anymore, how much money would Bill Gates have to drop in order for it to be worth the time for him to pick it up, right? It was like some ridiculous amount of money. And like, he won't even bend over to pick up $500. It's just not worth his time, you know? So, I mean, you know, I thought it's kind of an interesting double-edged sword, because on some hand, you know, those ruthless kind of business instincts and all of that, you know, maybe we can take some of that talent and that instead of making more money, maybe we can figure out, you know, how to use those minds to break open some of these challenges. You know, and it's almost like, you know, as I was saying, I really feel that the drug industry that we're talking about, that personalized medicine thing, I mean, as a scientist, I've seen, like, I actually did my thesis on something not too dissimilar from the DNA chipping, and let me tell you, there's a lot of blind ends that you could go down.
Well, it also generates an incredible amount of data, so just the ability to pull out
what's relevant.
Really useful.
And then it comes down to gut level feeling. You know, it's like, okay, you know, I see this gene that looks like it has something to do with cancer. I'm going to focus more on that than something that doesn't look like it does. But then that's mind bias on the data, right? It's not really letting the data speak for itself, because you can't. There is no such thing. I mean, you're always bringing your experience and your understanding into the system. And so it's just interesting to me that, you know, the way the drug companies are, their motivations, their business model. I mean, it's kind of like Hollywood movies. Why are Hollywood movies so terrible right now? Because, you know, the best movie would take all the money. And so there's a similar kind of thing going on here with the drug companies. They're the first or the best to take all of the market. And then, you know, and then everyone's got no financial incentive to fill in all of these little bigger gaps that may be more relevant to human suffering. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Gates Foundation since I live in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had any comment about them.
But I don't know that much about exactly how they do things, and you sort of hope that they're not just going in solely as a business, but trying to build some community wherever they're going as well. And, you know, I think these issues are interesting to think of on a lot of different levels. On our own personal health level, you know, what can we do to improve our own personal quality of life? Doesn't necessarily have to be spend more on treatments, but maybe take time for a yoga class once a week, or the other book that I didn't bring that I'd like to post for, by Dorothy Bass, about taking back your time and trying to keep the Sabbath. So we're all really super busy, we've got work, we've got kids, and we've got school, and we've got a million different things. Even church activities can make you really busy, right? On a Sunday, we have 5 committee meetings or whatever after church. You know, just be more deliberate in what you choose to do, and maybe try and truly have some time that's Sabbath for you, even if it's not on a Sunday, and that can be health enhancing, to not always be running around from thing to thing. So that's something we can do for ourselves on a personal level, and then what can we do in our communities to strive for economic justice or more community, and then what can we do on the global level. There's a lot to be done, and if everyone did a little bit, things would probably improve.
Thank you.
Thank you.